Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon. On behalf of the Wyoming Supreme Court's Children's Justice Project, I would like to welcome you to the CJP monthly training series. The training is offered the second Thursday of every month from 12 p.m. to 1 p.m. for key stakeholders involved in the Wyoming juvenile court system. We have a great training lined up for you today. To download the materials for today's training, please visit the CJP website at www.courts.state.wy.us/CJP and click on the training tab. If you have questions, please call in during the last 10 minutes of the training. The phone number is 917-889-8064. Again, that number is 917-889-8064. You may also post questions and comments using the chat session on the Blog Talk Radio website. After today's training, please go to the CJP webpage to complete a survey. We hope you find today's training beneficial.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Blog Talk Radio. This is Whitney Agopian, the Wyoming Supreme Court's Children's Justice Project Coordinator. Today, our Blog Talk is on the Indian Child Welfare Act, and we have Kate Fort, the Director of the Indian Law Clinic at Michigan State University College of Law, here today to provide an overview of the history and purpose of ICWA, along with best practice tips and strategies for handling ICWA cases. I'd like to thank Kate for being here and taking time out of her very busy schedule. She's presenting this afternoon at the largest ICWA conference in the country. Is that correct, Kate?
It's the Indian Law Conference in the country. It's the Federal Bar Association's Indian Law Conference.
Great. Well, thank you for being here. I'll turn it over to you.
Great. Thank you. Yeah, I am Kate Fort. I am the director of the Indian Law Clinic at Michigan State University College of Law. In that position, I created and run the ICWA Appellate Project, which was designed to provide tribes with free and accurate and competent legal representation at the appellate level. So we do a great deal of research and writing on ICWA, particularly as the cases go up on appeal. My area of research is almost exclusively the Indian Child Welfare Act at this point. And so I'm just going to go through some sort of ICWA 101, and then if you are listening and have questions, I'd be happy to answer any questions that you can come up with. The Indian Child Welfare Act was Congress passed the Indian Child Welfare Act in 1978 in response to the overwhelming removal of Indian children from their families. At the time the law was passed, 25 to 35% of all Native children had been removed from their families, and more than 90% of them were being placed in non-Indian homes. So it's not just that children were being removed, it's that from their families, it's that they were being removed from their communities and their tribes and being placed in non-Indian foster and adoptive homes. There is extensive legislative history on the Indian Child Welfare Act. This took many, many years and many congressional sessions before it was passed in 78. It went through a great many versions. Which is always interesting to go back and see sort of how Congress and the Bureau of Indian Affairs and the Department of Justice and all the great many Native activists who made it happen, how they shaped the law. The interesting thing about the Indian Child Welfare Act is it's the first major act that Congress passed on behalf of children generally. It was passed before the 1980 Abuse Prevention Act for children, and it really is forward-thinking in its the elements that are in ICWA. When you look at ICWA today, if you compare what exists right now under Title IV-E requirements for placement of children, for standards of removal, and for reunification efforts, ICWA, you know, ICWA presaged all of that. One of the memos I was reading recently said something about ICWA comparing and we'll go into this active efforts versus reasonable efforts. And when ICWA was passed, there were no reasonable, there was no reasonable efforts requirement that is now part of the magic language, obviously, in every child welfare case in front of state court judges. So just to give you my perspective, obviously, I represent tribes. I work with parents' attorneys, but I don't represent parents or individuals in these cases. Tribal governments are, frankly, often a lot like state governments. I think that it's more likely than not that a tribal government is aligned with the removal of a child because tribal governments that I work with want their kids to be safe, right? And so that's what everybody wants. The other thing that I do in particular is I try to coordinate and organize a group of in-house attorneys who work directly for their tribes on the Indian Child Welfare Act. So through that work, I have the privilege and pleasure of getting to hear about what is happening in their state courts and in their county courts. So while I don't practice at the trial level, the information that I pass on does come directly from attorneys who are practicing regularly in the trial level across the country. In addition, I get emails every day from all of the legal databases, including some states, for all of the cases that have been decided on appeal on that day. And I read and categorize the Indian Child Welfare Act cases. And while I don't believe the materials are up this minute, I have set to send over the two articles. We've been writing annual ICWA articles so that practitioners have the ability to see the number of Indian Child Welfare Act cases that are published and what they are saying across the country. There are, on average, more than 200 ICWA appeals every single year. And usually,
Kate, we lost you there for a moment. Are you there?
I'm there. I'm sorry. I apologize.
No problem.
Was that?
Okay. You were just talking about the 200 appeals.
Great, 200 appeals. 35 to 45 of them are reported from across the country. And what I was saying was the interesting thing about ICWA cases is that because the Supreme Court in the Holyfield case, the leading case on ICWA, said that ICWA should be interpreted with uniformity across the states, we find that states look to each other for holdings and for other case law. So it's an interesting area of law because it's like having a national case law that's informed by each state's local practice. So I'm going to go through ICWA, and then obviously I don't personally practice in Wyoming, and I always make a little joke because of the way 4E has informed state practices, most states have very similar practices with slightly different terminology. And so I'm going to apologize in advance if my terminology for your hearings doesn't exactly match what Wyoming's terminology is, because Michigan's is different from everybody else's, and every state seems to have a different way of talking about it. So the thing to know if you're going to have an ICWA case, you have to have two things. You have to have an Indian child, and you have to have a child custody proceeding as defined by the law. In order to have an Indian child, you have to have a child who is either A, eligible, or is A member of a tribe or a citizen of a tribe, or B, the child is eligible for membership in the tribe and is the biological child of a member of the tribe. In order to determine whether you have an Indian child, you have to talk to the tribe. It's settled, well-settled law that tribes are the arbiters of their own citizenship. They are the only ones who can tell you whether a child is an Indian child or not. Since I was also asked to speak about best practices, even if you think you know whether the child is an Indian child or not, from a state worker or a state lawyer perspective, you still need to talk to the tribe. Even if you've talked to the tribe in the past about a sibling or about that very child, and you have another case, you need to notice and talk to the tribe again. Tribes determine their citizenship individually. Each tribe has a separate, different way of doing that. They do it in their constitution or in their codes. Tribes spend a lot of time carefully considering and discussing internally their citizenship requirements and how their citizenship is best reflected. And so if you have a case that's 5 years apart, you may have, the tribe may have changed its citizenship rules and laws, or the parent may have become enrolled during that time. So I often will see cases where on appeal, there's been a couple out of Montana where the Montana worker says, oh, yeah, this is an Indian child, and the tribe comes back and says, yeah, no, they're not actually, and that case went up. And so you should always be talking to the tribe, which we'll talk about in just a minute, on notice. The second thing that you need to have is a child custody proceeding. There are four child custody proceedings defined in ICWA. I think this might be one of the most difficult overlays of the law, of having the federal law on top of state proceedings, because this is what I was talking about, the terminology gets awkward. So your four child custody proceedings are the foster care proceeding, the termination of parental rights proceeding, a pre-adoptive placement, or an adoption proceeding. All four of those are defined as child custody proceedings in ICWA, and all four have their own definitions. I think the one that comes up the most is the foster care proceeding. So I had this pulled up so I could just read it to you all, because I think it's a really important piece. Foster care proceedings include guardianships, for example, but they say a foster care placement, which shall mean any action removing an Indian child from its parent or Indian custodian for temporary placement in a foster home or institution or the home of a guardian or a conservator, where the parent or Indian custodian cannot have the child returned upon demand, but where parental rights have not been terminated. All of those pieces of that definition have been litigated and come up all the time. In Michigan, the main piece of that definition that our courts have focused on is cannot have the child returned upon demand. So that includes, in our state, guardianships where the parent cannot have the child returned upon demand. Those are ICWA proceedings under the law. We also have the question that has come up a great deal lately, and the states are split on it, is if you have one respondent parent and one non-respondent parent, and the child is removed from the respondent parent, the one who's been filed against, and has been placed with the non-respondent parent. Because that definition says foster care, conservator, or guardianship, some states, California the largest, has determined that that is not an ICWA proceeding. Michigan, on the other hand, and a few other states, have focused on the cannot be returned upon demand, which means they have found that it is an ICWA proceeding. My best practice advice is if you are filing as a state against a parent and there is a child welfare case going on against the parent, and the parent cannot have the child returned upon demand unless they complete a state case plan, that is an ICWA case. ICWA does not apply to custody decisions after a divorce, right? That's a family law case. That is not where ICWA applies. However, because ICWA includes in its proceedings termination of parental rights, ICWA does include step-parent adoptions. Any termination of parental rights is covered by the Indian Child Welfare Act. And so a number of cases recently, in particular, out of Washington in Ray TAW, out of Arizona in Ray SS, and out of Colorado a couple of years ago, I don't have the initials, those have all been cases where the court has found that the termination of parental rights in a step-parent adoption is subject to the requirements of the Indian Child Welfare Act. So those are the two things you have to have, an Indian child and a child custody proceeding. The question that has been coming up a lot, and I think it was something that was brought up specifically when we were talking about this podcast, is often the issue of notice. And I have, I teach this class. I teach the Indian Child Welfare Act. I teach American Indian Children in the Law. It's an entire semester's worth of law school for students. But we have been sort of drilling down and really discussing the difference, what I would call inquiry versus notice. Notice is required by the law when you put a child into foster care or you are doing a termination of parental rights. It is defined in 25 U.S.C. 1912A. It says in any involuntary proceeding in a state court where the court knows or has reason to know that an Indian child is involved, the party, so it's not necessarily a state agency, but the party seeking the foster care placement of or termination of parental rights to an Indian child shall notify the parent or Indian custodian and the Indian child's tribe by registered mail with return receipt requested of the pending proceedings and of their right of intervention. So I think the piece that's very important there and that we litigate and talk about a lot is that initial part where the court knows or has reason to know that an Indian child is involved. The regulations that came out in 2016 that also now provide additional guidance and binding parts to ICWA under the Code of Federal Regulations instructs all state court judges to inquire of every party in front of them whether the child may be an Indian child. But as I said before, the only way you know for sure if a child is an Indian child is through their membership or citizenship in a tribe, and the only party that can tell you for certain whether that child is an enrolled citizen or member of a tribe is the tribe. So I have been thinking a lot about the purposes of inquiry, which is that initial knows or has reason to know. So the court asks, and someone says, yeah, we're, you know, it's rarely as easy as someone saying, yep, we're enrolled at this tribe, right? Because we're in Northern Cheyenne. That's our tribe. And then it's easy. Then you know the tribe. You send the notice to that tribe with all the information, and the tribe lets you know. But a lot of times we'll get more general responses, right? I think I'm Cherokee. My mom says we're Native. I'm not sure where we're enrolled. I'm not sure. I was born at an IHS, Indian Health Services hospital, but I'm not sure what tribe I'm a member of. Those are the more difficult cases that require additional, what I would consider additional best practices, social work, which is to say interviewing the family, contacting family members directly. And people scoff at me when I say this at presentations, except for I will tell you the number of cases out there that say parents said grandma would know more about this. Grandma was in the courtroom when parents said this, and no one talked to grandparents about this issue. This is following up with the family members to get all the possible information, including where they live, where the parent was born, what potential tribes the child might be enrollable in. That is additional social work that just has to happen at the start of a case. Then most states, all states, send out notice at that time to all the possible tribes. Excuse me, to all the possible tribes the child might be enrolled in. That is best practice. It is also how you're doing the initial inquiry to determine if the child even is an Indian child. If you have determined that and the state and the tribe responds, yes, this child's an Indian child, then that tribe has to get notice. Say the case moves down the path, you move into termination of parental rights, that tribe has to get notice all along the way for that case. If a tribe responds, no, this child's not our child, if all the notices go out and they all come back with, no, this is not an Indian child, and you and the court and the attorneys feel that the due diligence has been done, all of the notices that could be sent have been sent and the responses have come back, then you can continue that case after a finding's been made. The child's not an Indian child. However, under the new regulations, if you do not know whether if you're waiting to hear back, there's reason to know the child's an Indian child, but you do not know for certain, that case is to be treated as an ICWA case until you can determine otherwise. Some states have been doing that practice for a while, but many had not. So it is a change. I get a lot of questions about what to do at emergency, what we call emergency hearings, depending on your state, right? Your 24-hour hearing, your 48-hour hearing, your emergency hearing, your shelter care hearing, whatever that very first hearing is after a child's been removed from the home, what standard applies there? Because if you go back into ICWA to look at what's required at a foster care placement, it includes the finding that there was clear and convincing evidence that the child, I'm pulling it up just so I make sure I get it exactly right, no foster care placement may be ordered in a proceeding in the absence of a determination. So you have to have clear and convincing evidence, including the testimony of a qualified expert witness, that the continued custody of the child by the parent or Indian custodian is likely to result in serious emotional or physical damage to the child. Then, of course, the other provision that most we talk about the most, right? This is all in 1912D. Any party seeking to effect a foster care placement shall satisfy the court that active efforts have been made to provide remedial services and rehabilitative programs designed to prevent the breakup of the Indian family, and that these efforts have proven unsuccessful. So when you read ICWA, active efforts, qualified expert witness, and clear and convincing evidence are all what you're supposed to have before you place a child in foster care. So one hopes with the new changes to the federal funding formula under Title IV-E using Families First, which provides a shift in funding from group home care to preventative care with families, that states will be able to meet this burden when a child is removed, to meet that heightened standard of a foster care placement, because they will have already been involved with the parent prior to that removal. However, at this point in time, I have sympathy, you know, for states that come to me and people who come to me and say, look, how are we supposed to get a qualified expert witness if we are still in the notice part, but we've had to remove the child for the child's safety, right? In that case, you're operating under 25 U.S.C. 1922, emergency proceedings. The law allows for a child to be removed from the home in an emergency situation. And 1922 has a higher standard. So I have been advising those who've had been trying to figure this out and how to do all of the parts in the right order, that at that first hearing, that you meet the emergency standard, which is the order is to prevent imminent physical damage or harm to the child. That means that at the time the hearing is held, there is still imminent physical damage or harm. So if you go and look at some of the examples that came out of South Dakota in the recent big federal lawsuit there, the example would involve the removal of the children from a babysitter who was who was either drunk or high, or there were so the police. The children were removed from the babysitter that the parent had left the children with. The parent comes to the court. The court continues the case for another, in those cases, right, 60 days to 180 days, which was found by the lower federal court to be unconstitutional. If you had that scenario play out and you came into your first emergency hearing and the parent shows up and the parent is has no issues and there was no real issues in the home except for the fact that children weren't being properly supervised, then that child is no longer in imminent physical danger, right? Imminent physical damage or harm, physical. That child should go back, not to say that you dismiss the whole case, but the child should be returned to the home with additional potentially finding for additional jurisdiction for services from the state. And that would be meeting the 1922 standard before getting to your 1912 foster care standard. Those are just all really technical issues at that very beginning stage. I get the most questions from people about notice, about the emergency standards, and about the standards at that first hearing. So those all are wrapped in together. Then we all know the case kind of goes on, right? We have a longer, let's say the petition is substantiated, the children are removed from the home, and we're looking, and the tribe responds, yes, this child is our child. The child is a tribal member. So at that stage, the tribe itself has three options. The tribe can do nothing. It's an ICWA case whether the tribe involves itself or not. It doesn't matter. You still have to meet the ICWA standards. The tribe can intervene in the case, the intervention is an intervention of right, the tribe can't be denied intervention under the law. Or the tribe can petition the case, to transfer the case to tribal court. And a state court shall transfer the case absent good cause to the contrary. That means that Congress, in the legislative history, is very clear on this. Congress presumed tribal jurisdiction over tribal children. As they said in the hearings and in the report on ICWA over and over again, what they heard was tribes have those solutions to these issues. You have to let us make the decisions about our own kids. And that is what ICWA is attempting to do, is to let tribes make the decisions over their kids when they have the capacity and ability to do so, and if they can bring their child back to tribal court. What Congress was looking at in that good cause provision primarily was inconvenient forum. It's explicit in the legislative history that the good cause to not transfer was to prevent inconvenient forum problems for witnesses and parties to the case. If a tribe can ameliorate or make it easier to go to tribal court, some tribal courts will hold court in other parts of the state in order to make sure everyone can make the court, or other tribes have fairly large and sophisticated video conferencing technology that they can hold court that way without people moving, then that is one way that tribes can ameliorate being too far from the child's physical location. The thing that happens a great deal with transfer cases and that they tried to address in the regulations is that when you start an ICWA case, it's the same as starting a regular child welfare case, and the goal, of course, is reunification. In order to do reunification, if a parent lives, you have to keep the child close to the parent. In Michigan, the example I always use is we have tribes in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan that are approximately 9 hours away from the Detroit metro area where a number of families live. So if a child is removed from our family in the Detroit metro area, tribes in the Upper Peninsula will often agree to the foster care placement and continued state jurisdiction over their children during the period of reunification in the hopes that keeping the family together, participating in the case at the state, will help with the reunification. When a case moves from reunification to termination of parental rights, many times that is when tribes will ask to transfer the case, will want to ensure the placement of the children is something that they're comfortable with for permanency purposes rather than reunification purposes. And it's also a lot of times when a state will say, why is this happening now? Why is this suddenly happening now? And it's usually because of the fact pattern that I just described. There's just certain, you know, they're trying to balance every, ICWA is a balance of parent, children, and tribal interests. And all of the provisions of ICWA, you can see that balance attempting. And sometimes that can be a really hard balance to meet. So we're moving ahead in the case. You have a foster care. The first thing is the placement, right? Where are the children placed? ICWA has what we call placement preferences. I think it's important to note that in the foster care placement preference, the preferences only come after a paragraph on what else needs to be part of the placement. So a state court shall follow the placement preferences absent good cause to the contrary. But under 25 U.S.C. 1915b, foster care placement or pre-adoptive placements, any child in foster care shall be placed in the least restrictive setting, which most approximates a family, and in which his special needs, if any, may be met. The child shall also be placed within reasonable proximity to his or her home, taking into account any special needs of the child. Then, in any foster care placement, preference shall be given, in absence of good cause to the contrary, to a placement with, first, a member of the child's extended family. The first preference does not make any distinction about whether the extended family is native family or non-native family. It's simply keeping the child with their extended family. The second is a foster home licensed, approved, or specified by the Indian Child's tribe. So that may be a home that has been licensed by the tribe, and many tribes have their licensing agencies, right? But it may also be one that the tribe agrees to placing the child with that meets that first paragraph, so approved or specified, right? Part three, the third preference is an Indian foster home licensed or approved by an authorized non-Indian licensing authority. That means state-licensed foster homes that are native foster homes, that the parents in those homes are native parents. And finally, four, which we don't often use, I haven't seen very often, but some places have these, which is an institution for children approved by an Indian tribe or operated by an Indian organization, which has a program suitable to meet the Indian child's needs. So those are the foster care placement preferences. We do a lot of litigation on placement preferences, but they are not usually the foster care placement preferences, which include all of the provisions that I just listed for you, including the good cause provision. Once a child is in the placement and they've met the placement preferences and the court has made that finding, then the agency has to start working with the parents to ensure that active efforts are being provided to the family. Active efforts for years, as many, many of you would know, was never defined. And as I said, it was the first attempt by Congress to say that there should be efforts to keep a family together. Active efforts predates reasonable efforts. When we wrote the Michigan Indian Family Preservation Act, which is the law that governs cases involving Native children in Michigan, our state social workers specifically asked if we could please define active efforts. And there was very mixed feelings about this because some tribes have different tribes have different feelings about what active efforts looks like. Generally speaking, courts have found that active efforts cannot be passive efforts. They cannot be writing up a case plan and handing it to the family. It has to be walking the family through the case plan. It has to be, one of my favorites is removing the barriers to completing the case plan. So if the barrier is transportation, the barrier is, whatever the barrier is to completing the case plan, it's active to remove those barriers. When the federal government did the federal regulations, they defined active efforts. And the elements are very similar, actually, to our Michigan Indian Family Preservation Act. So the definition in the reg says that active efforts means affirmative, active, thorough, and timely efforts. There's been a lot of cases on what is timely, what it means to have a case, provide efforts to a family, whether you have to provide them for each individual child, if you have a family who goes through the system a lot. And I believe under this new definition that, in fact, you're going to have to demonstrate active efforts for each case and each child. There are a few states that have adopted a futile efforts standard, that once efforts become futile, that they no longer need to provide them. We have not had a futile efforts case be decided under the regulations, and I will be curious to see how that works given the requirement of timeliness. Those efforts then are intended primarily to maintain or reunite an Indian child with his or her family. When the agency is involved in the proceeding, the efforts must involve assisting the parent through the steps of the case plan and with accessing or developing the resources necessary to satisfy the case plan, which is what I was referencing to remove the barriers. The active efforts should be provided in a manner consistent with the prevailing social and cultural conditions and way of life of the child's tribe and be conducted in partnership with the child's parents, extended family members, Indian custodians, and the tribe. Active efforts are to be tailored to the facts and circumstances of the case. Then the regulations go on to list 11 elements that could be considered, may include, for example, and I'm not going to read those all to you. It's under the regulation is under, I always get them mixed up. This one is 23. It's under 25 CFR 23.2 is the definition. But the elements that they list are fairly broad and provide both ideas of efforts for the child and for the family. Because there are cases where under if that, where there would be considered aggravated circumstances, right, where termination might happen quickly, where the parent was accused of harming the child, and as a result of that, the parent is in prison for harming the child. It's hard to have a conversation. I think that's one of the hardest ones the tribal governments and I talk about, when they want to ensure there's active efforts, but also understand that there are no efforts that will reunify that parent and that child in extreme scenarios. There are enough elements in the active efforts definition of the federal regulations to provide those efforts to the child to keep her connected to her extended family and her tribe that allows the state to provide those active efforts, even in very extreme scenarios where it would be difficult to see how that would work. If active efforts have been provided and they have failed, then the case obviously moves into a termination of parental rights, or if the active efforts are provided and they succeed, a reunification, which we don't talk about enough, frankly, or acknowledge enough, the parents who go through and are reunified. I think the best programs I've seen that provide attorneys for Native parents include having parent mentors and parents who have been through the system and have reunified with their children are able to talk to parents about what it's like to do that. And I think that a focus and a refocus on how we help reunification efforts through a healing to wellness or a drug court model, one that involves a team of people helping a family, is where we have to go, not just with ICWA cases, frankly, but with all of our child welfare cases. Regardless, once we move into termination of parental rights under ICWA, there is another whole level of proof that you have to meet that is very similar to the foster care placement, but instead of clear and convincing evidence, you have to find evidence beyond a reasonable doubt that the child, that going back with the parents, will cause serious physical damage or harm to the child. And then you also need to have the expert witness testify and then make the finding. The expert witness testimony, and I always think that an hour is so long, and I look at the time and realize we have not even hit expert witness. This is why it's an entire class in law school that I teach. So the qualified expert witness testimony, I believe, is one of the most difficult and misunderstood areas of the Indian Child Welfare Act. It's, again, something that's relatively clear from the congressional history, from the legislative history, what Congress was trying to do. Congress was trying to prevent the bias, the implicit bias, that occurs in cases that allows for us to have so many, to this day, Native children when white children are not. Native children are 4 times more likely at their first encounter with a judge to be placed in foster care than a white child. It's true, while the numbers are better than they were in the 70s, that implicit bias exists today. And the qualified expert witness testimony is an attempt to address that issue. But in order to do so, there's some important caveats about that. The qualified witness testimony, expert witness testimony, is the state's burden or the party that's removing the child or terminating parental rights. It is not the tribe's burden to provide the state with a qualified expert witness. It means that the state has to convince, a best practice, a member of the child's tribe that the child would be safer in foster care, or that the child's parents and relationship, their termination of parental rights should happen. That means that someone from the community agrees, yes, we agree, this child is not safe in the home, this child will not be safe with the parental rights intact, right? It's complicated and difficult because most state agencies or state courts don't have that kind of connection with the child's tribe. So they often are relying on the tribe to provide that qualified expert witness. So if the tribe's attorney or the tribe's social worker agrees with the state, yes, we agree with you, foster care placement is appropriate, termination of parental rights is appropriate, then oftentimes the tribe will provide the qualified expert witness to the state so that they're available. But there are some tribes, I keep referencing Michigan because I am from Michigan, but there's a case in Michigan that I think is very instructive on this, where the tribe provided a qualified expert witness, and the qualified expert witness said, no, like, we don't agree with termination of parental rights for a number of reasons. One is we don't think you've met your burden. And the other is, as a tribe, we don't terminate parental rights. We have other options for permanency for our children. And the trial court judge went ahead and terminated parental rights anyway. And the Court of Appeals sent it back down and said, no, this is like the main element in ICWA of terminating parental rights. And I got a lot of complaints, you know, a lot of questions and complaints from the state saying, how are we supposed to deal with this if the tribe says straight up that they're not going to terminate parental rights? Well, this is where working, you know, working with the tribe and working together is really important. The state knew the tribe was going to testify to that for a long time. Michigan has long-term juvenile guardianships as an option to termination of parental rights. If the tribe is saying that it would prefer not to terminate parental rights and it won't provide a qualified expert witness to testify to that, then the state needs to come up with alternative ways to find permanency for that child that does not involve termination of parental rights. California has passed a law called Tribal Customary Adoption, where state courts in California use tribal adoption laws in order to effectuate permanency at the end of their state cases. Because so many ICWA cases, for various reasons that are too complicated to go into right now, in California are heard in state court, this was a way for tribes to ensure that their tribal codes and customary adoptions were being applied to their children in state court. Qualified expert witnesses, so this is what I always say to the state, is what I just said. But then I also have conversations with tribes. The qualified expert witness isn't the tribe's witness. The tribe can have a witness if they want. If the tribe wants to have a witness saying, we would like to testify as to the importance of clan and clan structure in our tribes, and this is why we want that, and the importance of this particular custom, we need this information in front of the judge, then the tribe should introduce that witness as the tribe's witness. The qualified expert witness has to testify in favor of foster care, placement, or termination of parental rights. So they may be asked by judges for additional information about the tribe, about the traditional child-rearing practices of the tribe, and to further effectuate why they're an expert witness in the case. But if the tribe is trying to get very specific and certain testimony in front of the court for various reasons, that is not always going to be the qualified expert witness. There may need to be a different witness to provide that information. I sympathize with state courts and state agencies trying to address and make sure that they have the qualified expert witness for these cases, but it is also an incredibly vital piece of the law that Congress spent a great deal of time thinking about and considering why they would have it there. And it is, I think, as important now as it was in 1978 to ensure that the qualified expert witness testimony is done properly and correctly during a foster care proceeding or a termination of parental rights. So, assuming that we've met all of the standards for termination of parental rights, the court has agreed to terminate parental rights, we are now into potentially the adoption of a child, and then we go into 1915, adoptive placements or preferences. I would note that the law says in any adoptive placement of an Indian child under state law, not in an adoptive placement because the state terminated parental rights. It says in any adoptive placement of an Indian child under state law, preference shall be given in absence of good cause to the contrary to a placement with. So you'll note the paragraph I referenced specifically in the foster care section 1915B is absent from 1915A. That's because this is the permanent placement. This is where the child will grow up. The placement is with a member of the child's extended family. So that's any member of the child's extended family, native or non-native. Two, other members of the Indian child's tribe, or three, other Indian families. There are a lot of reasons for all these preferences. That's an entire podcast of its own. But the one that's been getting a great deal of attention right now in the federal litigation is three other Indian families. And I think, well, we have not argued this much at the legal level, I think a really important piece of the legislative history in the report accompanying the law noted that potential adoptive families who were Native were virtually ignored by state agencies, that the discrimination was happening to adoptive Native parents or adoptive Native relatives who could take a child in, and that they were simply not considered or ignored entirely by agencies. I believe that's why, as much as any reason, that Part 3 other Indian families are there, to ensure that agencies are investigating all possible placements for a child who is a Native child, to ensure that she's kept in contact with her tribe, in contact with her culture, her religion, her family, her extended family, and her relatives, so she knows where she comes from and who she is. The other part about other Indian families is that, and I'm sure those of you who work with tribes in Wyoming recognize this, we have many related tribes that are individually federally recognized. Just again, as an example, in Michigan, we have more than one Odawa tribe that are federally recognized, but would be considered sister bands, right? Would be related. Same with Potawatomi tribes, three different federally recognized Potawatomi tribes just in Michigan alone. Potawatomi is a really good example because there are federally recognized Potawatomi tribes throughout the United States, right? Because of the history of federal removal of tribes from certain areas. Because of that, it means that there may be an Indian family that is a Potawatomi family that is not in the Indian child's tribe, but would still be a very appropriate placement for that child, and that would fit under three other Indian families. Those are the adoptive placements, and I would say that probably the most litigation that you hear about, if you hear about ICWA, it's because there are foster families fighting a change in placement under the adoptive placement, to ensure that the child is growing up with their culture for the rest of her life, not just for the 12 to 24 months that the child's in foster care. And those are the adopted place and preferences. I am coming up at the end of my time. I would just note, so that's a child welfare proceeding in a nutshell under ICWA. I would just note that if you ever work in voluntary cases, 1913 is parental rights voluntary termination. I would also note that cases have held, there have been some attempts by some states to claim that once a parent, and this I think is one of the most difficult areas, I keep saying that, but this one really has been litigated and difficult recently. If you have a parent who you filed a termination petition against, or they're under a state petition, they're a respondent parent, and they decide to voluntarily terminate their parental rights, that does not turn it into a 1913 voluntary case. The 1913 section was fairly clearly written for direct placement or direct consent adoptions. And even, I think, a best practice is even if you have a parent who is voluntarily terminating parental rights, ensuring that perhaps a qualified expert witness testifies or otherwise meeting certain elements of ICWA in case the parent does come back and decide to reverse their consent. We had that case. I've worked on a case like that very recently where a parent consented under threat of state termination and then didn't like the fact that the children were placed in a different placement and then came back and revoked his consent, which was arguably voluntary and under Michigan law was found to be voluntary and was allowed to revoke, which meant that we never in Michigan now have an issue with permanency for children when a parent voluntarily consents to termination of parental rights in state cases. That's a fairly narrow issue, but I just think that you should be aware of it. Most states have found that in that situation, that is not a 25 U.S.C. 1913 situation, and that you are still under the 1912 requirements, which are the ones that we discussed involving active efforts, qualified expert witness, and heightened burden of proof. But that gets me to 10 minutes to the hour, and I'm not sure if there's any questions that I can answer, but listening to my own voice for that long I'm going to take a minute and have a drink of water.
Thank you for speaking with us, Kate. That was very informative, and I know I learned a lot. I just have a general question for you. Do you have any recommendations for good resources for people looking to learn more?
Yes, and I'm going to send you some today. I have some. So when you go to the website regarding the resources about ICWA, I'm going to send the appendix to my casebook, which is forthcoming this spring, and that includes the law, the regulations, and then the BIA guidelines, which are pretty long. They're about 100 pages long, but they provide a lot of guidance to both the regulations and the law. So if you have a question about a specific thing I mentioned, the guidelines would be where I would start first. Other references include the ABA's Indian Child Welfare Act handbook. If you are a child's attorney and you have the NACC Red Book, Matthew Pletcher and I wrote the chapter on ICWA in that book. While it has not been updated in a while, it's still fairly useful. The NARF ICWA handbook, which is online and is presented in a question and answer style. And frankly, NARF's page, it's www.narf.org/ICWA. And that has all sorts of legislative history and the handbook I mentioned and all sorts of stuff. I run a blog with Matthew Fletcher. He's the lead on it, and I do all the ICWA work on the blog. It's called Turtle Talk, and that's just Turtle Talk, all one word, .blog. If you go there and you look at my name or you look at the ICWA Appellate Project, I collect all of the litigation, federal litigation that we've been dealing with, which we didn't, is another whole podcast there. And I also collect state ICWA laws, state pro hoc vice laws for ICWA attorneys. All of that information is freely available at turtletalk.blog/ICWA.
Great. Thank you. Well, I would want to give just like a thank you. Oh, go ahead.
Oh, no.
I'm sorry. I thought I was cutting you off. We appreciate you being here and taking the time out of your schedule, and best of luck on your presentation at the panel today.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me, and I appreciate you dedicating an hour of this to ICWA. It's important.
Well, we really appreciate you spending the time with us. Have a great day.
Thanks. You too. Bye.